on the Fusiform Gyrus 12, but on the ability to summon up the memories, experiences, and feelings associated with them. Basically, being able to identify the face of someone you know comes with a lot of meaning. It also gives them meaning. The people you know and love. My mom already means a lot to me. She's my mom, after all. But would she mean even more if I could identify her face? I say to her, just promise me you won't be one of those couples that stays together for the children. That only screws people up, including the children. I toss the juice box, take a breath, say the thing I probably shouldn't. You deserve better. The first attempts at facial recognition technology were made in the 1960s. Every face has distinct landmarks, about 80 of them, and the technology works by measuring these. Width of the nose, distance between the eyes, length of the jaw. All these things are added together to create a sort of face print. Okay, so that particular kind of technology is beyond me, but what I can do is this. I stay up for hours connecting the wires that make up the robot's brain. This is a delicate job, like surgery. You can have the grandest design in the whole fucking world, but the thing every single book or video or website will tell you is that you need a complete circuit, perfectly wired, in order for the motors to work. If a single wire is disconnected, the motors won't spin, and your robot won't function. I can't do anything about my own brain. I can make sure the red wire goes here, the black wire goes there. Must get the wiring right. Must make the motor spin. I'm going to fill this robot's mind with fully working Fusiform Gyrus 12s. He won't just have one. He'll have 100.
Libby. Before dinner, I tell my dad I'm going over to our neighborhood Walgreens to buy some girl things. 10 minutes later, I'm walking up and down the aisles, fluorescent lights blinding me, filling a basket with junk food. Everything I used to eat. Cookies, chips, soda. People are staring at me, and I know how I look, the fat girl getting ready to binge. I don't care. I suddenly want everything. There's not enough food on these shelves, not even with Halloween around the corner. I'm grabbing bags of candy, and the basket is full, so I march to the front of the store and find a cart, and I throw the basket in there and go back up and down the same aisles, filling it with all the food I missed. I'm standing by the cereal, reaching for a box of Honey Nut Cheerios, when I feel my chest clenching, but not unclenching. It clenches tighter and tighter, like someone has wrapped a corset around it. My palms are wet. My head is compressing, growing and shrinking at the same time. I can hear my breathing, and it's so amplified that to my own ears, I sound like Darth Vader. A woman at the end of the aisle is frozen as she watches me. She looks scared. A boy comes over wearing a Walgreens uniform, and he's maybe 16 years old. He goes, "Are you okay, miss?" My breathing is getting louder, and I cover my ears to block it out. And that's when the ceiling starts to spin, and the air disappears, and my lungs stop working, and I can't breathe at all. I drop everything and run away from the cart and all that food until I'm out the door. I stand in the parking lot, bent over at the waist, breathing in the fresh night air. And then I lie flat on the ground, as if this will open my lungs wider and make them work again, only the breath won't come. And then I close my eyes, and everything goes black. This is the way it happened 3 years ago. My lungs stopped working, and all the air everywhere, in my house, in the world, disappeared, leaving me on my back, unable to talk or move. There was only panic. I open my eyes, and instead of the dingy metal ceiling of a truck, I see the sky. Get up, Libby. I push myself to sitting and wait as the world rights itself. I look around slowly so that things don't tilt or spin. Inside Walgreens, I can see the 16-year-old boy with a phone to his ear and someone on his way out the door to help the girl lying in the parking lot. On your feet, I pull myself to standing, and as I do, this feeling comes over me. It's this kind of quiet, peaceful feeling. And that's her. That's my mom. I want it to last, to keep her with me. Live, 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 live. And then I breathe. I breathe. At home, I stand in front of my mirror wearing the bright purple bikini I bought myself when I first lost the weight. The tags are still attached because I've never actually worn it, but now I rip them off and let them fall onto the carpet. I look at myself. In the glass, George watches me with the same expression he always wears, and I think, if only people were more like him. He looks at me the way he does when I'm fully clothed, with makeup or without, laughing or crying. He is unwavering, which may be the thing I love most about him. Still in my bikini, I sit down on my bed and open my laptop. I stare at the screen for approximately 10 seconds, and then the words just pour right out of me. The next day. Libby. It's the first day of swimming, which means for the entire hour of gym class, I'll be fulfilling one of my worst nightmares. Parading around in front of my classmates, wearing the world's smallest, most unflattering piece of clothing. I'm in the locker room with 30 other girls, and this is exactly how the nightmare always begins. Everyone who isn't Caroline Luchamp or Bailey Bishop stares into their lockers, as if this will somehow hide them from sight. Even Kendra Wu is cheating by sitting down on the bench, talking a mile a minute like she's the most confident thing in the world, when she's draping a towel around her lap. She ties this around her as she stands, and I know this move, because I've done it 100 times. I want to shout, "We still see you, Kendra! You can't hide from the eyes of your peers!" But who cares? You look great! We all look great! Our bodies are wondrous, miraculous things, and we shouldn't ever feel ashamed of them! Bailey is talking to me about a lifeguard named Brandon Something, who was her first real-life crush, not to be confused with her first crush of all, Winnie the Pooh's Christopher Robin. She leans against the locker and waves her hands, like she always does when she talks. And of course she looks like she just stepped off the pages of 17, even in the ugly, shapeless blob that is our regulation black one-piece. I'm the heaviest girl here, by a mile, and everyone keeps glancing at me to see when I'm going to take it all off, probably because it will make them feel better about their own bodies. I move as if I'm in slow motion, determined to run out the bell. I nudge off one shoe, and then the other, and place them, one and then the other, neatly, gingerly in my locker, as if they're made of the finest glass. I remove my bracelet and take the greatest, tenderest care to tuck it into my bag where it will be safe. I do everything but write it a poem. That is how long I'm taking to ensure its comfort. I reach into my pocket and pull out a hair tie, and then, as if we have hours to get ready, I pull my hair back and smooth it into place, every last strand, just like I'm a squad captain for the damsels. Caroline walks by and says in my direction, "You can't delay the inevitable." But even Miss High and Mighty can't get to me today. Finally, it's just Bailey and me and a girl named Margaret Harrison, who is chattering into her phone. Our teacher, Ms. Riley, comes whisking through, and with barely a glance at any of us, goes, "Margaret, phone. Bailey, pool. Libby, swimsuit." She would be an amazing drill sergeant. Bailey waves, "See you out there, Libs," and goes bounding off, hair swinging, long legs high-stepping. It is a wonder I like her. Now it's just Margaret and me. She's still blabbing away, but I really need her to disappear, so I start singing to myself, loudly. I rearrange my shoes. I check on my bracelet. She continues blabbing, but now she's watching me. We could be here for days. Finally, I'm like, screw it. I pull off my top, hang it up in the locker, pull off my jeans, hang them on the other hook. I grab my towel, slam the locker door closed. I throw the towel over my shoulder. I meet Margaret's eyes, and they are wide. The phone is still to her ear, but she has finally, finally stopped talking. I put one hand on my hip, the other behind my head. I do a little pose, and her face breaks into a smile. She says into the phone, "Yeah, I'm still here," and gives me a thumbs up. I stroll into the MVB Aquatic Center. Everyone stops. Just stops. From across the pool, Ms. Riley shouts, "What is that supposed to be, Strout?" I holler back, "A purple bikini." And then I strike the same pose, one hand on my hip, one hand behind my head. Ms. Riley is padding toward me, her feet going slap, slap, slap on the wet cement. "What is that on your stomach?" And she must be nearsighted, because I wrote it in giant letters across the widest swath of skin I own. "I am wanted," I say. "But don't worry about it washing off in the water. I used a permanent marker." And then I walk over to the deep end, drop my towel, and execute an Olympic-worthy dive that would impress even the most unimpressible judge. My mom learned to swim the year she turned 40, the year before she died. She and I took lessons at the municipal pool near the park, and together we learned to tread water, breathe, do the back float, do the breaststroke, dive. To me, swimming was as natural as walking or sleeping. I felt at home in the water. My mom was more nervous, something she blamed on her age. "You just need to trust the power of the water," I told her. "Our bodies are designed to float, no matter what. The water will hold you up." I haven't done much swimming in the years since, but it's amazing how something like that comes back to you. As I cut through the water now, I forget where I am. It's me and the water, and my mom just out of reach. I close my eyes, and I can see her in the lane next to mine. I come up for air and open my eyes, and I'm back in the high school swim center, surrounded by gawking, laughing girls. This jars me for a second, but only a second. It is my job in life, apparently, to teach gawking, laughing girls lessons about kindness. If you had told me when I was 7 or 8 that this was something I'd be taking on, that I would never get a break from it no matter how good I felt about myself, I would have said, "Thank you, but if it's all the same, I'll take another job, please. What else do you have for me?" I know what you're thinking. If you hate it so much and it's such a burden, just lose the weight, and then that job will go away. But I'm comfortable where I am. I may lose more weight. I may not. But why should what I weigh affect other people? I mean, unless I'm sitting on them, who cares? I find the ladder and climb out. I brush the hair off my face and check my stomach. The writing is still there. I pick up my towel and walk past them all into the locker room, where I dry off and pull on my shoes, which I chose especially for today. On one side, I've decorated them with this line from a separate piece. "Everyone has a moment in history which belongs particularly to him. This is mine."
Jack. I make my way through the crowd, pretending to be on my phone. I'm planning to avoid the main hall, even though it will mean going upstairs and around and down again to get to my next class. The closest stairs are in what we call the four corners, which is where the main hall branches off in four different directions, and if I'm wily enough, I can duck up these to the second floor. Otherwise, I'll have to trek all the way to the front hall and take the stairs there. I don't want to run into anyone. I hear my name, but I concentrate on the back of every head in front of me. The hall is jammed with people, and we're barely moving. Someone is shouting my name over and over. And then this tall girl with dark skin and a painted-on beauty mark by her eye yanks at my arm and goes, "Didn't you hear me? Caroline? I said your girlfriend's up there. She's the reason we can't get through."
Libby. I stand in the middle of the main hallway. The only thing I'm wearing other than my shoes is my bikini. My suit and hair are still damp, and I'm shivering a little, but I'm telling myself, this is your moment in history. This belongs to you. 5, 4, 3. Iris appears, out of breath. I say, did you bring them? Right here. She holds up a stack of papers. You may want to get out of here. She shakes her head. I'm staying. The bell rings and I jump. There's still time. I could run like the Flash and maybe only be seen by a couple of people. But I keep standing there. As doors are being thrown open. As the entire student population of MVB High School starts flooding the hall. As everyone is staring. As phones are held up. As I'm sure of it, 400 pictures are being taken. As my chest is clenching. As my head feels as if it's being filled with cotton. As my breathing grows raggedy and uneven. As my palms go clammy. I stand there.
Jack. I try to push my way through, but as I'm getting closer to the main hall, things slow down even more. And soon I'm trapped in a crowd, shuffling along, pressed into the girl in front of me, and the guy behind me, and the girl to my left, and the guy to my right. Caroline is somewhere nearby, but I've lost her.
Libby. Iris and I are handing out sheets of paper, one for everybody, and they are going fast. My classmates are snatching them up and walking off, reading them while others aim their phones at me and take pictures. I try to pose for as many as I can, because if I'm going out on the internet, damn it, I want to give them the best possible me. Seth Powell and his giant mohawk appear in front of me, and Jack Maslin is just behind him. Seth goes, "What's this all about? Is it Spirit Day?" He laughs so hard he shakes. Jack is not laughing. He says, "What are you doing?" I'm reminding people of some basic truths. Moses Hunt and his crew loom forward, and I give them a copy to share, even though they probably can't read. I say to Moses, "I hope you learn something, although I doubt you will." He reaches for me like he's going to hug me, and Jack goes, "Hey, fuck you, asshole, what's your problem?" Seth goes, "His problem is that's his girlfriend," and laughs slash shakes like a tambourine. I say to Jack, "Thanks anyway, but I don't need you to protect me." And he says, "You need to put some clothes on." Behind her desk, Principal Wasserman shakes her head. "I'm at a loss, Libby. Help me understand this." She holds up a copy of the thing I wrote, my treatise for the world. "Someone's been harassing you? Sending you letters? Why didn't you come to me?" I don't know who sent them, and even if I did, I wouldn't rat them out no matter how awful they are. But I felt like I needed to say something. I'm dressed now, but I'm still shivering. For one thing, my hair is damp. For another, I'm pissed. With a single comment, Jack Maslin has taken away some of the glory of my moment. "You need to put some clothes on." Principal Wasserman reads my treatise again, and then sets it down in front of her. She folds her hands on top of it and looks at me, and I can see the anger in her eyes, but I know it's not directed at me. "I'm sorry," she says. "Truly." My eyes are suddenly stinging, which takes me by surprise. I stare at my hands, willing myself not to cry. "No need to cry. You rocked it. You made your point. Maybe you even helped someone else today who needed to hear what you had to say." "We're done here." I look up. "Really? Just let this be the last time you take matters into your own hands, and let this be the last time I see you in here? Unless you get more letters. In that case, I want you to come here directly, without trying to address it on your own. And if you do find out who's sending them, I want to know that too." You Are Wanted by Libby Strout. You aren't wanted. Someone wrote this to me recently in an anonymous letter. I wonder who out there feels like this is an okay thing to say to another person. I mean, really. Think about it. You aren't wanted. It's pretty much the most despicable thing you could tell somebody. What they probably mean to say is, you are fat, and this disgusts me. So why not say that? You don't know if I'm wanted or not. But guess what? I am. Believe it or not, I actually have a family who loves me, and I also have friends. I've even made out with boys. The reason I haven't had sex is because I'm not ready yet. Not because no one wants me. The thing is, as hateful and small as you are, person who wrote that letter, I'm pretty damn delightful. I've got a good personality and a great brain, and I'm strong, and I can run. I'm resilient. I'm mighty. I'm going to do something with my life because I believe in myself. I may not know what that something is yet, but that's only because I am limitless. Can you say the same? Life is too short to judge others. It is not our job to tell someone what they feel or who they are. Why not spend some time on yourself instead? I don't know you, but I can guarantee you have some issues you can work on. And maybe you've got a fit body and a perfect face, but I'll wager you've got insecurities too. Ones that would keep you from stripping down to a purple bikini and modeling it in front of everyone. As for the rest of you, remember this. You are wanted. Big, small, tall, short, pretty, plain, friendly, shy. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Not even yourself. Especially not yourself.
Jack. I stand on the main floor of Maslin's, wishing baseball season lasted year-round. They didn't have to wait till spring, and that we were all required to play. If I'm designing a world, every person in it is wearing a uniform, and this is how we find each other. If this was how the world worked, I would recognize Monica Chapman, also standing on the main floor of Maslin's. I would know instantly that the woman my dad is talking to is her. I wouldn't have to wonder if she's been there other times before today, right in front of my eyes. Instead, I interrupt the two of them, standing too close near a Star Wars display, where anyone, including my mom, could walk in and see them. They break apart, and then I read my dad's name tag and the guilty look on his face. She says, "Hi, Jack." Maybe it's her, maybe it isn't, but I don't wait to find out. I look at my dad. I say, "You son of a bitch," and walk out. At home, I swipe everything off the basement shelves and onto the floor. I throw stuff into the trash. I go wild like a kid having a tantrum, crushing parts under my shoes, slamming things against the plywood table, breaking tools, and all this shit I spend so much time designing and building. I go wilder, finally hitting a wall until my hand is bleeding. The pain of it feels good, and I like that contact of fist and bone. I hit it again and again. It's a way to feel something without standing behind this invisible electric fence that divides me from everyone else. Half an hour later, I'm cleaning up the mess, all cool and collected, when a man skulks in wearing my dad's name tag. He takes in the chaos around us and then looks me in the eye. I'm ending it. With her. None of my business, man. I just wanted to tell you. Why now? What made you come to this life-altering decision? That, he says, nodding at me. That anger right there. I'd rather you didn't hate me. Don't put this on me. It's not on you. It's on me. I was given this second chance, not just beating cancer, but a second chance with your mom. And a second chance to figure out what I want to do in life. I thought you loved the store. I love what it means, and I love the history. I love going there as a kid. But that doesn't mean it's the thing I wanted to do with my life. I had plans. This throws me, because it's the first time I've ever thought about my dad doing anything else, or having other options. I wanted to be an architect, or an engineer. And this throws me again, because maybe we're more alike than I thought. And I'm not sure how I feel about this. The only thing I do know, thanks to you and Monica Chapman, is the kind of person I don't want to be. It's funny, right? That even though we're basically alone in here, he thumps his chest, it's easy to lose track of yourself. I want to say I know. I get it. It's easy to give everyone what they want, what's expected. The problem with doing this is you lose sight of where you truly begin and where the fake you, the one who tries to be everything to everyone, ends. He smiles this sad smile. I've been shitty. So I guess Dusty got to you too. I guess so. Marcus and his girlfriend Melinda are in our family room, hunched over his phone, whispering their heads off. Marcus looks up and says to me, "Have you seen this?" He holds out the phone. I go over, take the phone from him, and there is Libby Strout, wearing nothing but her electric purple bikini, basically telling the world to fuck off. I was there. I've already seen it. But now I'm looking at the way the light catches her hair, and at the handful of freckles that dot across her arms and chest, like beauty marks that aren't painted on. Then I make the mistake of reading the comments. Some of them are nasty, but some of them are really nice. I don't take account, but I'm relieved to see the nice ones seem to outnumber the nasty ones. I give the phone back to my brother, and he barely notices because he and Melinda have started arguing. She goes, "I'm serious. It's not funny, cuss." This is what she calls him. I feel sorry for her. I say, "Why do you feel sorry for her, da?" As in, duh. This is what I like to call her. She blinks her big, dumb eyes at me. "I mean, it can't be easy being her." "Why?" I shouldn't mess with her the way I do with Seth, but I can't help it. "Well, I mean, you know." She holds up the phone and points at the screen. She seems like she's doing all right to me. Libby's You Are Wanted paper is upstairs on my desk. Ever since I read it, I've been trying to ignore the voice that's saying, "This is your fault. If you hadn't grabbed her, she wouldn't be a target. And if she wasn't a target, she wouldn't have felt like she had to prove herself to the entire school."
Libby. Martin Van Buren High is actually really beautiful, which is weird when you stop to think of how many people over the past 90-some years of its lifetime have spent so much time dreading being here. We have a real honest-to-God art gallery in our school. Our gym seats 10,000 people. And Civic Auditorium, attached to the Athletic Center, is the town's venue for concerts and shows. There's a salad bar and a pizza bar and a sandwich bar in the cafeteria, and there's even a small convenience store by the nurse's office. But it might as well be Peacock Island Prison, in the middle of a lake in the deepest, most remote part of Russia, where prisoners spend 22 hours a day in their cells and only get visitors twice a year. This is what it can feel like to be here. Today is no exception. Everyone, and I mean everyone, knows my name now, and all of them can picture me in a bathing suit. Even the people who weren't actually there. The YouTube video is called "Fat Girl Fights Back, Libby Strout, Formerly America's Fattest Teen Tells Classmates, You Are Wanted." It was posted last night and already has 262,356 views. Imagine it. I can tell you from experience that it is really weird and really unsettling. That guy over there with the Game of Thrones notebook, that girl and her friends with their band instruments, the cheerleaders, the basketball team, and oh right, the teachers. I did not think this through. It may be my imagination, but every pair of eyes lands on me as I walk through the halls. I walk and breathe. Walk and breathe. I start to strut a little. I try adding in a sachet. I remember how it felt dancing in my room to the Spice Girls, and I tell myself, that is who you really are. Some kind of superstar, just like in the song. I only get one moo. Everyone else just stares. In the hallway, Mr. Levine says,
"Everything okay, Libby?"
Which tells me, whether he's seen it or not, he must know about Fat Girl Fights Back.
"Just because I see you in our conversation circles doesn't mean you can't talk to me. It is kind of what I do, you know."
"I know. Thanks, Mr. Levine. Everything's great. Really." I'm not sure he believes me, but I hurry off before he can ask me anything else. I eat lunch in the art room with Bailey, JV, and Iris, because right now it's more peaceful, i.e., less traumatic than the cafeteria. They start talking, as they always do, about what they'll do beyond school when MVB is over and we're free. Bailey is planning to be an artist and also a doctor, and JV is going to be a writer. At some point, Iris looks at me and says, "I wish I was like them. I wish I knew what I was going to do." "You could be a singer. If I had a voice like yours, Iris Engelbrecht, I would sing all day just to hear myself." Her ears turn bright pink. She takes a sip of her Diet Coke. "That's not a career. That's a hobby." She's quoting someone. Maybe her mom.
"Tell that to Taylor Swift."
I scroll through my phone, choose a song, and hit play. They all go quiet as I start dancing. I say, "I'm going to be a dancer. Maybe I'll even be a rockette." I kick my leg. I kick it as high as the sky. JV starts clapping and whistling. "I'm starting my own dance club. I'll take everyone who can't be a damsel or anyone who doesn't want to be a damsel. We won't dance in formation, and we won't dance with flags. We'll just get out there and do whatever we want, but we'll do it together." "I want to be in your dance club." Bailey is up and shaking it, hair flying.
"Me too."
JV climbs onto a desk, all jazz hands and waving arms. She tips an imaginary top hat and smiles the biggest, scariest stage smile anyone has ever seen. Iris sets down her Diet Coke. She dabs at her mouth with her napkin. And then she starts to sing along, drowning out the Spice Girls with that big, gorgeous voice of hers. She shimmies a little in her seat, shoulders moving to the left, shoulders moving to the right. I grab a paintbrush and hand it to her, and like that, it's not a paintbrush. It's a microphone. And we're not in a high school art room. We're on stage, all of us, together, doing our own thing. Until Mr. Grazer, art teacher, walks in and shouts, "What is going on in here?" Bailey pipes up.
"We're just expressing our art, Mr. G."
"Well, express it a little more quietly, Bailey."
Jack. A ring of chairs is arranged in the middle of the basketball court. It appears that in today's conversation circle, our very last one, we will be sitting in an actual circle. I almost turn around and walk out, but it's the final day after all, so I make myself take a seat, say hey to the collective group, and wait for Mr. Levine to join us. I stretch my legs in front of me, cross them at the ankle, tip my head back, close my eyes. Everyone will think I'm hungover or tired or just bored out of my mind, but actually my heart is beating a little too fast, a little too loud. Whatever this circle is about can't be good. I listen as everyone settles in, as their voices rise and fall. I hear Libby say something as she takes a seat, and then I hear the squeak of sneakers on the scuffed-up floor, and this is Mr. Levine. He says, "You're probably wondering why, in this conversation circle of ours, we're sitting in a circle." I open my eyes, sit up a little, try to look interested and like this doesn't scare the shit out of me. I glance over at Libby. I want to say, "I'm sorry, I miss you." But she's watching Mr. Levine, who's cradling a basketball. Today, we're going to take turns saying 5 positive things about each person here. So, if I'm starting, I'll say 5 great things about, let's say, Maddie. He tosses the ball to Maddie. "You're kind, punctual, polite, get along well with others, and you're a lot more confident than you were when we first started this circle." Then Maddie says 5 great things about me. Maddie goes, "You wear cool bow ties. You look like Doctor Who. You're pretty chill for a teacher. You don't lecture us too much. And you keep it interesting. She throws the ball back to Mr. Levine.
Excellent, Maddie.
And thank you. So next, I would throw the ball to Jack or Andy or Natasha or Travis or Libby or Kishan until I've said something about everyone. We'll go round and round till everyone has taken a turn. Questions? Kishan goes, like anything, as long as it's good. Let's say anything with a PG-13 rating. They all laugh except Kishan, who looks disappointed. So now we're all glancing around at each other, studying each other, no doubt trying to think of 5 nice things to say. I'm studying them too, but in a different way. After all this time, I can pick out Kishan in this group. And Natasha must be the girl with long brown hair with her hand on his leg. At least I hope so, for Kishan's sake. I know Libby because she's the largest of the girls. And I know Maddie thanks to Mr. Levine. But as usual, I'm having trouble with Andy and Travis. They're the same height, same build, and both have scraggly hair that falls in their eyes. You can tell some people by mannerisms, like the way they brush the hair off their face. These guys just blink on through it. I tell myself I'll be okay as long as Levine chooses someone else to go first. So now I try to think of what to say about these people. Kishan and Natasha were caught having sex in one of the bathrooms, which is by far the best reason any of us have for being here. But I can't exactly mention this as one of my positive things. Maddie is here for stealing makeup out of random lockers. Andy destroyed school property by pissing on it. And Travis, on a dare, lit up a joint during class. So yeah, the only person I can think of nice things to say about is Libby. And instead of thinking of 5 good things to say about her, I can think of 100. Levine says, Jack, why don't you start us off? Crap. I flash him a grin. Ladies first. Chivalry and all that. While I'm sure the ladies appreciate the gesture, I'm betting they won't mind in this case. He sits back in his chair, folds his arms across his chest, and waits. For whatever reason, I look right at Libby. Don't abandon me, Libby Strout. Not when I need you most. She frowns, and for a minute I expect her to tell me off or flip me off, or maybe just get up and walk out. But she must see my panic because she goes, I'm sorry, Mr. Levine, but before I forget, Travis, do we have a test tomorrow in driver's ed? She's looking at the guy across from her, the one in the black long-sleeved jersey. What? Fuck, do we? He blinks at her through his hair. His mouth popped open in an O, and suddenly I feel like laughing. I thought Dominguez said, or maybe that was another class. Oh, wait, I'm thinking of history. Mr. Levine is looking at her like he knows she's up to something, but all he says is, go ahead, Jack. Kishan's a good basketball player. Natasha is a positive person who's always smiling. Maddie seems very smart. Andy helped take us to state last year in football. Travis has a great collection of vintage t-shirts. That kind of thing. Here's what they say about me. Jack's good-looking. Jack's got it all together. Jack drives a cool car. Jack lives in a nice house. Jack's got a great smile. Jack's got great hair. Jack's smart. Jack's funny. Jack's a good baseball player. Jack will probably get into any college he applies to. I know they mean well, but I'm left feeling deflated. Maybe they're all feeling like this too, but I want to go, you don't know me. If that's all you think I am, you don't have a clue. But whose fault is that? I turn to Libby. You're kind. Probably the kindest person I know. You're also forgiving, at least a little, but I'm hoping a lot. And in my book, that's a superpower. Her eyes are on mine, and there's a lot going on there. You're smart as hell, and you don't take people's crap, least of all mine. You are who you are. You know who that is, and you aren't afraid of it. And how many of us can say that? She's not smiling, but it's not about what her mouth is doing. It's about her eyes. You're strong, too. It's not just a matter of being able to knock down a guy with a single shot to the jaw. Everyone laughs except her. I'm talking about inner strength. Like, if I would draw that inner strength, it might look a lot like a triangle made of carbon. That's the world's strongest structure and the world's strongest material. You also make things better for people around you. I'm about to go on, but Mr. Levine says, "That's actually more than five. I want you to keep going, but I'd like to get through everyone today." Good work, though, Jack. Way to kick this off. Libby is still looking at me, and her eyes are as open as the sky. And then there's this moment. It's almost like I see her. Not just the amber-colored eyes or the freckles on her cheeks, but really see her. Jack? It's Libby's turn. I rub the back of my neck, where the hairs are prickling. Yeah, sure. I throw the ball to her. She stares at the ball for a moment, rolling it around in her hands, delicately, carefully, like she's holding the entire world. Then she turns those eyes on me, and they're hard to read. She opens her mouth, closes it, opens it again. It turns out she doesn't have five things to say about me. She has only one. You're actually not a bad guy, Jack Maslin. But I'm not sure you know it yet.
Libby. I walk as fast as I can out of the gym without actually breaking into a run. But Jack falls in step beside me, afro billowing and blowing like it comes with its own wind effects. He says, "Thanks for what you said in there. It was nothing. Not to me. By the way, what you did yesterday? You're my hero. You told me to put clothes on. Because Moses Hunt was getting a little too close, and who knows what he might have done. I didn't want anyone grabbing you." Oh, the irony. And then, because for some reason I can't help myself, I tell him, "I've apparently gone viral." "I know. I saw. Listen, some girl will see that video, and you're going to give her the courage to buy her own purple bikini. You're going to make a difference. Just watch. Girls everywhere, of all sizes, are going to want one. Clothing manufacturers across the globe will be working overtime to produce enough purple swimsuits to satisfy the demand. Girls will stop asking, 'Do these jeans make my butt look big?' They won't care if it looks big or small. They'll wear what they want to wear and fucking own it." He smiles, and there's something in it that makes me want to smile. But I don't, because this is the boy who broke my heart. He says, "It may not look like it, but you're actually smiling."
Jack. I can't wait for Christmas, so I carry Dusty's robot down the hall to his room and knock on the door. He yells, "Come in!" I push open the door, but I don't go in because he's still not really talking to me. Instead, I set the robot on the floor and send it inside. I've named it the Shit Kicker. It's a superhero. The robot goes zooming into Dusty's room, where it says, "Hello, Dusty. I'm fighting shittiness everywhere. The Shit Kicker is here to kick your ass." Dusty goes, "My ass?" And then starts laughing. It's the best sound in the world. I poke my head into the room, and my little brother is rolling across his bed, and then he's up and on his feet and examining the robot from every angle. He sees me and frowns. I hit the remote, and the Shit Kicker says, "It's you and me against the world, Dusty." My brother stares at the robot and shakes his head. "It's almost like it recognized me. How did you do that?" The truth is, the Shit Kicker can't recognize Dusty any more than I can, but I programmed it so that Dusty is the only one it calls by name. To the Shit Kicker, everyone is Dusty. "Magic," I say, "so that he can always find you." I push a button on the remote, and the Shit Kicker says, "Don't be shitty." And then I hit another button, and the robot is kicking its legs, only it's not really kicking anything. It's dancing. The Jackson 5 come cranking out of the speaker in old Shit Kicker's chest, and now Dusty is dancing along with it. I hand my brother the remote, and then I'm dancing too. And a couple of minutes later, Dusty goes, "Is he carrying a purse?" And of course he is. Because the shit kicker knows only the cool kids use them. And Dusty's howling over this. And now the three of us are dancing in sync. And as good as Dusty and I are, there's no doubt about it. The shit kicker is definitely the man. Top Two Things I Miss About Libby by Jack Maslin. 1. The way I feel when I'm with her. Like I just swallowed the sun and it's shooting out of every pore. 2. Everything.
4 days later.
Jack. I'm due at Cam's house around 9. Caroline will be there. Everyone will be there. I don't want to see everyone, or anyone, actually. But this is the way it has to be. I'm Jack Maslin, after all. I've got a reputation to uphold. I take a shower, pull on my clothes, shake out my hair. I grab the car keys, and I'm almost out of there when my dad, thick eyebrows, pale skin, Maslin shirt, comes chasing after me. "Hey, Jack, can we talk to you a minute?" I think of every excuse. I've got a date, and I'm already running late. True. I think the car's on fire. Hopefully not true. I don't want to talk to you. True, true, true. "Sure thing, Daddy-O. What's up?" "But make it quick. The ladies don't like to be kept waiting." I almost add, "As you know." This is serious, buddy. Marcus, Dusty, and I sit on the couch side by side. Mom is opposite us on the ottoman that's the size of a small boat. She leans forward, hands on her knees, as if she might leap up at any minute. Dad clears his throat. "Your mom and I love each other very much. And we love you. The three of you are our life, and we'd never do anything to hurt you." He goes on like this for a while, all about how much he loves us, and how he's lucky to have such a great supportive family. How we were all there for him when he was sick, and he can never tell us what that means to him. Meanwhile, Marcus, Dusty, and I are all looking at Mom because she's the one who tells it like it is. But she doesn't say anything. She doesn't even look at us. She's staring at some point just past our father, who is still talking. Finally, Dusty raises his hand and goes, "Are you getting divorced?" Dad's face crumples, and I can't look. Now no one's saying anything, and finally, in this very quiet voice, Mom says, "Your father and I think it's best to separate for a little while. We need to work on some things in our marriage, but those issues have nothing to do with you." The conversation doesn't end there. Dusty has questions, and Marcus wants to know what this means for us, like, where will we live, and can we still go to college? Meanwhile, I'm here on the outside. Always on the outside, even as the world crumbles around me, face pressed to the glass that divides us, looking in.
Libby. We're on our way to pick up Iris, and JV is driving because she's the only one with a license. Bailey and I sit in back. Bailey says, "Dave Kaminsky's having a party. I promised I'd stop by, just for a minute." JV catches my eye in the mirror.
"Libs, it's kind of up to you."
Bailey says, "Jack won't be there."
I say, "How do you know?"
"He doesn't really go to parties." We roll up in front of Iris's house, but Iris is nowhere to be seen. JV shoots her a text, and we sit there. When she still doesn't appear, JV swears under her breath, "I'll be back." She leaves the engine running and goes marching up the walk. "Libs?" Bailey is peering at me, eyebrows raised like banners, mouth in a half-smile, eyes wide and shining. "Okay. Because, I mean, why not? What do I have to lose?" And then, because I don't have anything to lose, I say, "Why didn't you stick up for me when I was bullied? Back in fifth grade? When Moses Hunt started banning me from the playground? Why didn't you do something or at least come talk to me? I stood there every day, too terrified to set one foot on the playground, and you never once came over to talk to me. I say it matter-of-factly. I'm not emotional. I'm not upset. I just genuinely want to know. At first, I'm not sure she hears me. But then her eyebrows sink back into place, and her half-smile disappears, and her eyes go cloudy. I don't know, Libs. I think I told myself we were friends, but not best friends, and that you seemed like you were okay. You're still like that. You get letters from some horrible person, and you brush it off. Jack tells you he can't go out with you anymore, and you're fine. But it was a big deal back then, and it was kind of obvious, but no one did anything. And I felt awful because I didn't. And then one day you were gone. You didn't come back. Is that why you're so nice to me now? It's why I came up and said hi to you on the first day of school, but it's not why I'm nice to you. I'm nice because I like you. I'm just really, really, really sorry I wasn't a good friend then. And it doesn't change anything, but it's enough. I could have been a better friend, too. I could have talked to you. I could have told you how I was feeling. And then she hugs me, and I inhale her hair, which tastes like rainbows and peach pie, exactly how you think Bailey Bishop's hair would taste. When we walk into Dave Kaminsky's, the first person I see is Mick from Copenhagen. He's in the living room dancing in this circle of girls, and his black hair is shining blue-black like crow feathers. Next to me, JV goes, "Hello, Mick from Copenhagen," in this throaty voice, and then pretends to faint into Iris's arms. I follow Bailey through the crowd, and Dave Kaminsky's house doesn't look like a house, but some sort of fraternity. It is literally crammed with so many people we can barely move. The music is loud, and people are doing their best to dance, but it's more like jumping straight up and down in place. My first high school party. The music is good, and so I'm shaking my hips a little as I walk, and when I accidentally bump some guy, he yells, "Watch it!" I tell my hips to be still and behave themselves, and finally we break through into the dining room, where Dave Kaminsky is playing poker with a group of guys and a couple of girls. Bailey goes up to Dave and says something in his ear, and suddenly he's grabbing her until she's sitting on his lap, and she's laughing and play-hitting him, and then she hugs him and comes back over to us. "Dave's really glad we're here." I say, "Apparently." And then Dave Kaminsky catches my eye and gives me this nod. And there's something in it that feels almost like an apology.
Jack. Caroline. Dark skin, smells like cinnamon, beauty mark by her eye, and I are in Cam's sister's room. Literally every inch of wall is covered in posters of Boy Parade. So it's a little like sitting in the middle of a very small arena full of 20-year-old guys. Their faces are everywhere, and their eyes are glued to us. They are smiling these unnaturally white smiles that glow in the dark. She thinks I've brought her in here to make out. But instead, I'm trying to see once and for all if I can trick sweet Caroline into coming out and having a real conversation with me. Because I miss Libby. Because I miss talking to someone the way I can talk to her. After all this time, Caroline and I have our routine memorized. Until recently, I try to get in her pants, and she takes off her clothes, because I'm not allowed to in case I mess up her hair. What comes next is we will almost have sex. And I'll hold her for a little while, and then I'll lie there wondering when. Usually my heart's not in it, only my body. And my mind cooperates by going blank. But tonight, my mind is in charge. Like Mr. Levine, it wants to know why. Why are you doing this? Why are you even sitting here with this girl? Why do you keep ending up with this person? Why don't you just stop, Jack? Why don't you just live your life and be yourself? Which is why I go, "What's the best thing that's ever happened to you?" She blinks at me. I'm supposed to say Jack Maslin, right? Only if it's true, baby. Come on. I want to know. In the whole history of your life, what's the best thing that's ever happened to you? I don't know. Maybe when Chloe was born? Chloe is her little sister. What's the worst thing that ever happened? When my cat Damon got hit by a car. The worst thing that ever happened to me was fucking up my relationship with Libby Strout. But I say, there's got to be something else. Why? Because you used to be different? Shy? Quiet? Dorky? God, don't remind me. Okay, so what's one thing people don't know about you? She frowns down at the bed. I hate the color brown. I don't like turtles. And I got my wisdom teeth out when I was 14. Boring, boring, boring. I almost say, I have a neurological glitch in my brain that keeps me from recognizing faces. Boom! Mwahahaha! But instead, I ask another question and another. And the whole time she answers in this flat, dull voice and picks at the comforter. As she talks, I'm barely listening to her answers. Instead, I'm thinking, all this time I thought she was a security blanket. But there's no security here. How can there be when she doesn't see me any more than I see her? I might as well be alone. And of course, I am alone. And then suddenly she lifts her shirt over her hair and drops it onto the floor. She readjusts her bra strap and leans back seductively. She bites her bottom lip, which is also part of the routine. A couple of years ago, the bottom lip thing slayed me. I'm about to say something along the lines of, please put your shirt back on. When this shift happens before my eyes, and Caroline grows paler and fuller until she's no longer sitting there. It's Libby Strout, leaning back on one arm, plucking at the strap of her electric purple bikini. But she's talking. And telling me things, and laughing, and asking me questions, and I'm talking. And then she's sitting up and leaning in, and we're both just talking until she says, hello? And snaps her fingers in my face. And it's Caroline again. I stare at her, hoping she'll morph back into Libby, and she goes, what is your problem? Why are you being so weird? And she's got this sexy bra and this sexy body. And there isn't a single guy at MVB High, even the ones who are afraid of her, who wouldn't want to be me right now. I lay my hand on her leg, and it's smooth and feels like satin, and all I can think is, I don't love Caroline. I don't even like Caroline. I forced myself to think of things I like about this Caroline right now, the only one who's here. She smells good. Her teeth are very, even. Her eyes are okay. Her mouth is nice. I mean, I guess. But the shit she says? Not so nice. Libby has interesting things to say that aren't cruel or selfish. I say to my brain, why are you doing this? Why can't you stop thinking about Libby? Why are you fucking with me? And as I'm sitting here having this in-depth conversation with my brain, Caroline goes, I think I'm ready. For what? It. I'm trying to look into her eyes, but the room is dark except for the light that slips in under the door, and her phone, which goes bright every other minute from all the texts coming in. It. Sex, Jack. I'm ready to have sex. With you. And then here comes the attitude. Unless you don't want to. I've only been wanting to since birth, but inexplicably I hear myself say, why now? What? Why are you suddenly ready now? After all this time, what changed? Apparently my mouth has a mind of its own because it won't stop talking. My manlier parts are going, stop talking, you idiot, shut the fuck up. But my mouth isn't listening. Why isn't it listening? Are you gonna argue with me about this? Is this really where you want to do it for the first time? I mean, look around you. I point to the walls of posters. I dislodge a stuffed animal from under my back and wave it in her face. You wouldn't really want to do it in front of this little guy, would you? Are you freaking kidding me? And she shoves me so hard I go flying off the bed.